This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this month, the bipartisan Iraq Study Group recommended talks with all of Iraq's neighbors, specifically including Iran. At his news conference this morning, President Bush said no and put the idea not in the context of Iraq, but as part of the ongoing international effort to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions. And that is hardly the only major issue between Washington and Tehran. Iran is the principal sponsor of Hezbollah, the powerful Shiite group that battled Israel in Lebanon this past summer, and the power base of a wider Shia movement that worries America's Sunni allies like Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And Iran competes directly with the U.S. for influence in Iraq, a battle most observers believe Iran is winning. Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has also shown hostility to Israel, most recently as host to an international conference that questioned the facts of the Holocaust. Nevertheless, as former Secretary of State James Baker points out, the United States talked with enemies like the Soviet Union in the past. Iran was helpful in Afghanistan and might be again in Iraq. Later in the program, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us. If you have questions about the 2008 presidential field, Evan, we hardly knew ye. The fragility of Democratic control in the Senate or other political issues, you can send us email now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, should we talk with Iran? What's to lose? What's to gain? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email comments to talk@npr.org. We begin with historian, classicist, and columnist Victor Davis Hanson, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute. He joins us now from the studios of member station KVPR in Fresno, California. Nice to have you back on the program, Victor.
Thank you for having me.
You argue that negotiation with Iran would be strategic and moral mistake. Why don't we take those one at a time? Strategic mistake?
Yes, I think so. I think we would be talking from a perceived weakness. We don't have a good record of asking theocracies or autocracies to help us out when they don't see it is in their interest. And I know the Iraq Study Group said that it was not in the interest of Iran to see instability in Iraq, but actually the opposite is true. What they fear most is a democracy emerging in places like Afghanistan, Lebanon, and Iraq. And we don't have a good record with this regime. Remember, it was Jimmy Carter who sent Ramsey Clark to sort of appease them to get the hostages back that failed. Realists on the right sent Oliver North to deal with them. Bill Clinton has praised the democracy as liberal in temper, and none of this has worked in the past. I think that Jim Baker's model with the Soviet Union is flawed. Iran does not have 7,000 nuclear weapons or 300 divisions that threaten the West. So we had to talk to Soviet Union, and we really talked them only when they showed signs of liberalization. A better model would be probably our relations with Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, where we did not talk to them and we ostracized them until they made a gesture of giving up their own WMD. If Iran would do just what Gaddafi did, they would probably get the United States at the table with them.
And a moral mistake. Why would it be a moral mistake?
Well, there's anti-Semitism prevalent in the region, but Iran is a special case. We don't really see people, at least at the nation state level, who are hosting an international conference, not just to deny the facts or question the facts, I think, but rather to deny the existence of the Holocaust. And that's a precursor, an intellectual and spiritual precursor to eliminate Israel. We haven't had a head of a Middle Eastern regime promise not once, not twice, but seven or eight times to eliminate Israel and then apparently proceed with the means to do just that. I mean, after all, Iran has about 100 billion barrels of oil in reserve. That would give it, based on its current consumption, about 200 years of energy sufficiency. And so why would they want to enrich uranium other than to build a weapon, which we know from their rejection of the EU3 and the UN, that's what they're trying to do. And unlike other states, they seem to be immune from ideas of deterrence. It's bad enough that Pakistan, an autocracy, has a bomb, but there's no India next to Iran that's democratic that could offer some type of deterrence. And when a leader says that he speaks at the United Nations and for 30 minutes nobody can blink their eyes, and he talks about a mystical imam, you almost get the impression that this man would like to lose 30 million or so Iranians to restore Persian Shia supremacy in the annals of Islam by taking out Israel. So it's a moral mistake to deal with somebody who, at least in tone and temperament seems to ape the Third Reich worst spokesman.
Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation. Robert E. Hunter was U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 1993 to 1998. He's now a senior advisor to the RAND Corporation, and he's been kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A. Thanks, Ambassador Hunter, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And you think the United States should engage with Iran at this moment. Why?
I think we should have been doing it for a long time. It's like climbing Everest. It's because it's there. It's because Iran is a major civilization, major country, sits in a very critical part of the world. It is going to be a player unless somehow we were to eliminate it. And it's better to see if you can engage them to achieve what we want to achieve. Not to be friendly to them, have a tea party, to be nice to talk, but if we have strategic objectives in the region where talking to Iran might, just might, help us do better than we are today, what's there to lose? In fact, I believe that we should be talking to people generally in the world. We're one of the few countries in the world that does a kind of a moral calculus before we decide whether to talk to somebody that would be strategically useful to have a dialogue with. We lost all kind of years when we decided the communist Chinese were beyond the pale, and it took Richard Nixon finally to open discussions with China, and even at that point, they were pouring weapons into Vietnam and killing Americans on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. So that this argument, what about the moral argument that Victor Davis Hanson mentions?
I think President Ahmadinejad has committed one of the great moral crimes of the recent past. Not just a crime of saying this Holocaust didn't exist, but by making his people a target because of it, and by cheapening all the efforts of people who are going to try to talk about the problems that Muslims might have, the problems Palestinians might have, and the like. This is something which is totally reprehensible, totally objectionable. But that doesn't mean there aren't people in Iran or even himself. You hold your nose and you deal with them on things that matter to us if that can help us meet our strategic objectives and, yes, save American lives. That's what we're talking about. How do we save American lives here? Iran helped us in the 1991 war against Iraq. President George H.W. Bush confirmed it. Iran helped us in Afghanistan when we overthrew the Taliban. Are there things that we can have a common interest with Iran in Iraq and elsewhere? I don't know. But you don't find that out unless you sit down and talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Victor Davis Hanson, people have pointed that out, that after the fall of the Taliban and even during the fall of the Taliban, Iran was helpful when it saw itself as, when it saw it's in its interest to help the United States.
It was tangential. It wasn't helpful. It allowed people, after all, we have reports that Osama bin Laden's own son was in Iran. And the same thing in the 91 Gulf War. To the extent that it can play one side off against the other, it practices real politique like any other nation, but it's never – that theocracy has never had any of the interests of the United States at heart at all. Mm. And we're going to give legitimacy to someone who's a horrific character. And there's ways of dealing with Iran without talking at the official level to them. We can encourage Shia democracy in Iraq that will send a strong message. We can talk and engage with dissidents in Iran who are risking their lives, the people who shouted – Mr. Ahmadinejad the other day are probably going to be hunted down by his gangs and goons, but we can make it clear to the world that we support those people. We can try to make sure that Afghanistan and Lebanon and Iraq stabilize without the help of Iran so that reformers are confident that they don't have to make concessions to that theocracy. And we can talk to the Gulf sheikdoms to be careful. I mean, this idea that you talk just to talk reminds me of Stanley Baldwin's quip that if anybody had just talked to Hitler after 1939, they could have stopped the invasion of France.
I didn't say talk just to talk. I said talk to achieve what we want. Incidentally, we're the only people who are not talking to the Iranians. And it's true. They're not going to do things because they like us. They're going to do things because it advances their interests. If we can find some common ground, maybe that will help. And incidentally, we have a kind of a terrible.
What are their interests?
What are their interests?
Their interests are to overthrow the democracy in Iraq, to overthrow the democracy in Afghanistan, to overthrow the democracy in Lebanon, to get nuclear weapons, to hold the sheikdoms hostage about oil pricing, and to threaten, if not eliminate, Israel. I don't see how any of those things dovetail with any of our interests.
What is it we want to achieve? We want to keep Iran from getting the bomb. We want to stop them from supporting terrorism. And we'd like some other things, too. I mean, this nonsense about the Holocaust in Israel, we'd like them to get off this craziness. One reason, incidentally, Ahmadinejad does this is because it provokes such an international reaction and isolates his enemies. He learned something from Fidel Castro on that. Every time we've tried to get along with Fidel Castro, he's done something outrageous like invade Angola. Ahmadinejad is not crazy. He knows that this is a way of getting people to respond in that way. The fact is that he is making his country vulnerable. Now, what's the best way to stop them from moving in the particular directions we don't want? One would be to offer some kind of trade. You know, we have seen the negotiations now with the three European states and the head of the European Council with the Iranians for the last 3 years. But one thing we have never been willing to allow them to talk about is the possibility of Iranian security. I mean, here are people surrounded by an awful lot of bad customers, just as we see them as a bad customer. We won't even consider the idea of maybe their security. We won't even consider the idea of maybe lifting sanctions if they behave. If they behave. And as a result, Ahmadinejad and the other people around there are laughing all the way to the political bank as the people who want to deal with us are totally undercut. That's the real world.
Their security is enhanced when the Taliban are gone and there's a Karzai government. Their security is enhanced if their democracy emerges in Iraq. Their security is enhanced if Lebanon's democratic, unless that's not in their interest to be peaceful, and they want to be aggressive and create a Shia protectorate. But the way it is now, the United States, by de facto supporting consensual governments and constitutional forms of government in the region, has helped Iran immensely. But that's not what they want.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, listeners will be invited to join the conversation. We're talking with Victor Davis Hanson and Robert Hunter. Should we talk with Iran? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the proposal by the Iraq Study Group that the United States should work with Iran to find a solution to the violence in Iraq. President Bush says no to the idea. Speaking in Dubai today, Tony Blair, British Prime Minister, accused elements of Iran's government of openly supporting terrorism in Iraq. He called Iran's meddling there and around the Middle East deadly serious. So should the U.S. talk with Iran, and if so, how? Our guests are Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Robert E. Hunter, senior advisor to the RAND Corporation, former U.S. ambassador to NATO. And, of course, you're welcome to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Peter. Peter calling us from Berkeley.
Hi, thanks for this opportunity.
Sure.
I think the solution is let's just talk to the top, but talk to the base of the pyramid in Iran. Mediated talks that are open and public, preferably on television and preferably including the whole wide world. The problem of Iran is part of the problem of the whole world. We need truly representative democracies everywhere, and we need them at the global level. And I think isolation is actually, and alienation are the breeding ground of evil, and coming together as a body, as the whole world, is the breeding ground of good. In fact, that idea is in the root word of good. So, Hatami, the former president of Iran, gave that fabulous talk at Harvard where he said this double standard has to be eliminated. And your first guest had made this point about, well, we had to talk to the Soviets because they had 6,000 nuclear weapons. Well, that wasn't true for 7 years prior to the talks that occurred between Gorbachev and Reagan. There had been a dearth of summit meetings for seven long years.
Yes, Peter, you're talking, though, about public negotiations, not normally the avenue for diplomacy.
Well, that's the point. We need new solutions, and we need to involve the people, the whole body of intelligence of the people of Iran, not just the, you know, barely elected leaders sometimes. I mean...
Well, let's get a response from Robert Hunter.
Okay.
Well, we already have public negotiations. Ahmadinejad has said things about the Holocaust, a negative. He's written two letters to President Bush, both of which said, let's talk. That's a positive.
One to President Bush, one to the American people.
And one to the American people, you're right. We didn't respond. The things that are coming back, what Tony Blair said that you've just mentioned, what the president said, this is part of an open negotiation. What we really need is exactly what the speaker said, for us to present what our requirements are, real requirements, not the I would wish this. Your person and your other caller is talking about as though somehow if it weren't for Iran, there would be a democracy that's successful in Iraq. That's nonsense. One reason we want to talk to Iran is because we are failing in Iraq, and we'd be failing even if Iran didn't exist. All right, so let's present it in the outside. I think what President Bush should have done when Ahmadinejad had written to him is write him an 18-page letter back and state our case and say, fine, let's have a discussion. Let's have it in the middle of Times Square, so to speak. Let's have it in the open. Among other things, what that does is that helps to validate for the people of Iran who really do want a different relationship to the outside world, validates for them the possibility.
With all due respect, they know that we have sympathy and empathy for them. Popular culture transmits that every day. But the problem is not that we don't want to talk to the people of Iran. We do, but they're not allowed to express their opinion. We see that with press conferences. They're silenced. They're jailed every day. What we need to do is to, as your first caller said, to express our desire to talk to the people and to pressure the regime in Iran to allow the people to express themselves, which they can't do. Remember, this is a regime that's turned upside down the entire notion of Israel. After the Holocaust, it was supposed to be a refuge for the world's Jewry. And man, this man comes along 60 years after the Holocaust and says, this is a one-bomb state. In other words, this is a place where they're all put together and we can get rid of them in one fell swoop. And the idea that we're going to sit down with this man who does not allow any dissent within his own country and we're going to legitimize him is absolutely callous and absurd.
Let's get another caller in. This is Bill. Bill with us from Driggs, Idaho.
Hi. I still don't understand, and I'd like to ask the gentleman what benefit the United States gets from not talking to Iran or Syria or North Korea or any of these people that we disagree with. It doesn't seem to me that you get anything from not talking. You can't lose anything by talking. And this idea that us talking to them legitimizes them somehow, they're already legitimized. They're there. They're in charge. I just don't understand the concept.
It's an old diplomatic concept. There's an old diplomatic concept. There was a point where Churchill told his ministers there's not going to be any more talk with Hitler. And that's the concept that a state doesn't get a free pass to do and say what it wants and expect normal diplomatic relations. That's what diplomatic pressure is used for. And it also assumes that we're not talking in back channels. Every state talks in vicarious ways to another state. They know that. There's ways of communicating with Iran through third parties. And we've been communicating with Iran vis-a-vis the EU3 and the UN nonproliferation efforts. What we're talking about is a formal head-to-head negotiations, which all it will do is enhance Mr. Ahmadinejad's position vis-a-vis his own domestic constituencies.
Robert Hunter?
Well, I think if you looked around the Middle East, and this is a tragic thing I'm saying, Mr. Ahmadinejad is either the first or second most popular person around the Middle East, in part because he's been standing up to precisely the kind of thing the other caller is talking about. You know, one of the things, if you want to appeal to the average Iranian, is you've got to show respect for that culture. You don't call the country part of an axis of evil. You don't say you have no right to high technology. You don't say you have no right to security. If I wanted to design a policy to help support Mr. Ahmadinejad in power, I do exactly what we're doing today. Your caller on the line now is exactly right if you want to serve American interests.
At his news conference today, President Bush spoke, I have to say, very respectfully of the Iranian people and the Iranian culture, very disrespectfully of the Iranian government. But what he appeared to be holding out, Robert Hunter, is this idea that, look, you're isolated, you're out of step with history, and if we talk to you now, you know, that's the threat. That's what the card he's trying to hold over the Iranian government. Your people will continue to be isolated unless you come across and talk to us. And he put it in the context of the nuclear weapons talks.
Did he say, unless you come across and talk to us? We haven't been willing to talk to them.
No, that's exactly what he said. He said that they can even do it under the auspices of the EU3. They can do it with the UN. All they have to do is just say that we do not want to violate international standards of nonproliferation.
Delighted to hear that.
He said that all along. All he's doing is extending the same policy we did to Muammar Gaddafi.
And let Ambassador Hunter respond.
We offered to join the talks by the Europeans, but then we put in a poison pill that the Iranians have to stop enrichment before the talks start, rather than as the first item on the agenda and something to be achieved in a matter of weeks, which is the Iranian position. I'm not arguing their position. I'm just saying we have missed opportunity after opportunity to try to find out if Iran will do things to help save American lives. That's what it's all about. Now, if you're an average Iranian and you see Pakistan with a bomb, America with troops next door, America threatening, under some circumstances, to attack your country, calling you an axis of evil, saying you have no right to high technology, the average Iranian is going to say, maybe this thug, Ahmadinejad, is not so bad after all. We have done everything possible to reinforce him in power rather than doing those things which would undercut him.
Mm-hmm. I think the average Iranian, with all due respect, is probably thinking, why in the world are our hard-won dollars when the economy's in shambles? Why are they going to places like Hezbollah to start a war with Israel? Why are we buying North Korean missiles and threatened to destroy Israel? Why are we trying to send our youth, our weapons in to destroy people in Iraq that are trying to create a democracy? Why are we trying to shelter terrorists that come from Afghanistan and have been in collusion with the Taliban, of all people, whom we don't like? That's what a lot of people in Iran right now are asking themselves. In fact, of all the countries in the United States,
that is utter
youth
nonsense.
It is true. Because the Iranian people, all right, I stopped interrupting you.
Go ahead, Victor.
By all accounts, the United States is not unpopular among the youth of Iran. We're not unpopular because they realize that we stand for principles that their own government does not do. And that it is true that the more that autocracies don't like us, the more their constituencies seem to admire us. Mm-hmm. The Libyan people like us precisely because we were firm with Gaddafi and brought concessions for them by not giving in and not legitimizing that regime. We can do the same model with Iran. All they have to do is do what Gaddafi did. Mm. Just come clean on their nuclear proliferation, and we will have normalized relations, and the people will appreciate us. If we sit down with this man after what he's done, we will lose all of our support within Iran.
And
it doesn't mean that we have to call them an axis of evil, or it doesn't mean we have to be provocative. We can do exactly what we're doing. Encourage the UN, encourage the EU3, do not pursue loud rhetoric, but just don't talk with these people at this particular time until they agree to meet just minimum requirements of nonproliferation.
And Robert Hunter, I'm going to give you the last word.
I think if we were to go to the Europeans and say, you can tell the Iranians, if they are squeaky clean on the nuclears, total inspection, they get out of the terror business, we, the United States, we authorize you to say this, you can tell the Iranians we'll give security guarantees, the United States won't attack you. Many Iranians think we are getting ready for an attack, and we will lift sanctions, at which point Ahmadinejad loses his base. If we'd be prepared to do that, I don't care whether we talk to them or not, but we have steadfastly refused to do that. And if you're an Iranian, you look at that and you say, here come the American bombs, not here comes American democracy.
Former NATO ambassador, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, Robert E. Hunter, with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Ambassador Hunter is currently a senior advisor to the RAND Corporation. Victor Davis Hanson, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, who wrote Just Smile at Iran and Wait, Don't Talk, is one of his recent columns. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
Victor Davis Hanson joined us from the studios of KVPR in Fresno, California, and we thank him for his time today. But There are also practical issues if we're going to have conversations with Iran. How do you negotiate with an enemy? Joining us now is Joe McMillan, a senior fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil. Happy to be here.
And the problems of negotiating with enemies, indeed countries that the United States has been at war with, these are not new.
No, they're not. We've had negotiations that we've conducted in the midst of wars going back to the earliest days of our country. We negotiated with the Barbary Pirates even as we were conducting naval operations against them. And one of the best cases is the negotiations we conducted in 1814 to resolve the War of 1812 with Britain, which went on for about 6 months. During that 6 months, we had Washington, D.C. burned. We had the Battle of Fort McHenry that led to our national anthem. We had the Battle of Lake Champlain, one of the great naval victories in the history of the United States Navy. All of this taking place at the same time.
The Battle of New Orleans. The
Battle of New Orleans came a little bit afterwards, but it was in train as the negotiations were going on.
Yet the world has changed a great deal since 1814.
The world has changed a great deal, and the nature of this particular set of negotiations is, of course, quite different as well. We're not at war with Iran the way that we were at war with Great Britain at the time. And the conflict in Iraq is clearly a much more complicated affair than our two-way war that we were conducting with the British, although we do have to keep in mind that from the British perspective, the British were in some ways were in the same seat that we're in now. They were conducting conflict with a number of other countries and in a much wider environment, and we were the ones that were only dealing with one adversary.
Bilaterally. We're talking about the prospect of talks with Iran, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our guest is Joe McMillan, a senior fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. You've pointed out a number of principles that ought to apply in these circumstances, one of which is fighting and talking are two sides of the same coin, which is sort of the reverse of Clausewitz's famous dicta that the war is the extension of politics by other
exactly.
means.
Exactly. When you're conducting negotiations with someone that you're fighting with, negotiations are an extension of war by other means. It's exactly right. We tend to think of war and diplomacy as two different sort of polar opposites. And we put that into effect a lot of times by taking an approach that says we won't start talking until there's a ceasefire. We see a ceasefire in a conflict as a precondition to start a negotiation. What we have to remember as we go into a negotiation is that the ceasefire favors the side that's losing because it gives the side that's losing an opportunity to regroup, to restructure, and rebuild. Repeatedly, we've had cases in Korea, for example, where there were times that we were winning, and as a precondition to start serious negotiations, we've been the one insisting on a ceasefire. That's so when I say that they're two different sides of the same coin. The military to do wartime negotiations effectively, you need to set up a dynamic that the other side thinks that you can achieve militarily all of the things and more that you're trying to get at the bargaining table so that he believes that the best deal he's going to get is at the bargaining table.
Keep expectations realistic, you say.
Keep expectations realistic. Don't expect that you're going to achieve much more at the bargaining table than you could achieve on the battlefield. The example that I think is very telling, again, goes back to the Ghent negotiations. The British came into the negotiations with the United States wanting us to give up most of the Midwest, return the Louisiana Purchase to Spain, give up a slice of northern Maine, forfeit any right to fortify the Great Lakes, a long string of demands that bore no relationship to what British forces had accomplished at that point of the war. Now, the British had in mind a campaign that was going to lead them to a path where they expected that this would look like an attractive settlement to the United States. But in fact, they lost on the battlefield. They lost at Lake Champlain. They lost in Baltimore. And suddenly, there was no way that they could achieve those objectives. But they stuck to them, this very unrealistic expectation, for several months after it was clear that that simply wasn't going to come to pass. And finally had to settle for a very minimalist return to the status quo before the war.
Mm-hmm. In recent American history, though, it's not been negotiation. We just have a few seconds left. It's been unconditional surrender that has been the traditional American negotiating tactic.
Well, that was the negotiating tactic, obviously, in World War II, and to a certain extent in the first Gulf War, mm-hmm. in 1991.
Civil War, too.
And in the Civil War as well. But it was not... for instance, the line that we took in Korea, it was not the line we took in Vietnam, and has not been the line that we've taken in a number of somewhat more minor conflicts that we've been involved in over the year that tend to be overshadowed when we look at them against the backdrop of the great conflicts.
Another of Joe McMillan's ideas is patience. Unfortunately, we have no time for them. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it. When we come back, the Political Junkie. This is Talk of the Nation.